someone can be in Baptist land without ever having set foot in a Baptist church. And it, you know, it affects, you know, families, and it's not just what happens within the church, but it is the influence of the faith group in the broader community, in the broader culture.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Krista Brown. Over the last two decades, she has been one of the leading advocates speaking out against clergy sexual abuse and cover-ups in the Southern Baptist Convention, the nation's largest Protestant denomination. We'll be mostly talking with her about her forthcoming new book, Baptist Land, a memoir of abuse, betrayal, and transformation, where she unpacks her own story of clergy sexual abuse and the trauma that has come as she has spoken out against it and found church and denominational leaders unwilling to do anything about the epidemic of clergy sexual abuse. I was really glad that we could have this conversation, and I'm so appreciative of all of the work that Krista has been doing. Now, before we jump into the conversation, I want to remind you that if you haven't done so already, you really should subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness, where we send in-depth news and analysis at the intersection of faith and politics straight to your inbox. Learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Krista Brown on Baptist Land. Well, Krista, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Brian.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad to have you here on the program and to talk with you about your new memoir, Baptist Land, a memoir of abuse, betrayal, and transformation. And I mean, I'll admit, I'm glad I read it, but I mean, it was a difficult book, and I hope people will check it out, but also have to kind of know what they're getting into when they read it. I've known a little bit of your story, but there was so much more to it and in a lot of different areas than what I realized or expected. So before we get into some of your story, I guess I want to first just talk about why. Why did you decide? I mean, because you're vulnerable, and that's putting it lightly. Yes.
It feels pretty raw. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's a level of courage to be this open and honest about your story, stories with your family and others. So, well, talk to us a little bit about the process of why you decided to even put all of this out there.
Well, of course, you're absolutely right. I do feel a lot of trepidation about putting this out there because it is a very vulnerable story that makes me feel very exposed. But I felt it was important because for near two decades now, I've been hearing the stories of clergy sex abuse survivors, just scores upon scores of stories. And I can't tell all those stories, but what I can do is tell my own, and hopefully people will see some of the patterns within my own story. And some early readers among survivors have already told me how much this resonates with them. I wanted to include stuff about my family because I think that is an aspect of this that very seldom gets talked about because it is so incredibly painful. But I have known many, many survivors who, it doesn't just affect the survivor in the moment of the abuse, but it has this ripple effect that goes through families and causes estrangement because faith is so tied in and linked with identity. And there's just many, many survivors who have told me these stories of estrangement in their families when they began to speak out. And they are incredibly painful stories. And so I thought that was something that needed to be talked about. And the other thing, as always, you know, what I really hope, I just hold this fundamental belief that truth is a moral force in the universe. And I mean, this is a memoir, so it's my story, but I hope in years to come, people will look back on this and it will be, they will look back on everything that the Southern Baptist Convention did and didn't do, and other evangelical groups and other faith groups. And they'll just say, oh my, you know, it will seem so awful as to be almost inconceivable that, you know, this multi-million dollar faith group could turn its back on and fail to protect, not just fail, but actually refuse to protect child sex abuse victims and survivors. And it will seem almost inconceivable. And so I hope that this story will help in that long-term documentation process. Because I think memoirs do contribute. You know, they're just a little tiny slice of history, but I think they do contribute to documenting things in history. And so I hope for that.
You mentioned this idea of, and it's heavy in your story, but that you also hear this from others, of estrangement with family, particularly after speaking out, you know, in some cases decades later, speaking out about abuse that had occurred, and then creating this rift and estrangement. Why do you think that happens, right? Because, I mean, I think we expect sometimes in those moments, well, our family, like those would be the ones that would rally to us in our darkest moments and our most vulnerable moments. And yet, as you noted, there's this pattern of estrangement that occurs.
Right. Yes, often that is not what happens. Family does not rally around the survivor. You know, I think we all, as human beings, are prone to lapse into denial when we come face to face with uncomfortable truths. And that happens. But I also just think that the reality of child sex abuse, it's like an earthquake. I mean, it just seismically alters the entire terrain. And that's very, very uncomfortable for people. And so I think even in families, what they really want is just the safety and familiarity of the terrain that they've known, of the status quo, to the point that they will even effectively turn their backs on their own kids, usually now grown. And I think part of that is an identity thing. People identify with their faith, and when that faith gets challenged, even unintentionally, because I think most survivors aren't really intending to do that, but it is felt as a challenge, and that goes right to the heart of who we are, which is also why clergy sex abuse, when sexual abuse is linked with faith, is so incredibly damaging, because again, faith is part of identity. It goes, it just encompasses everything and goes right to the heart of who we are, and challenges everything we've ever known about ourselves and about God.
Yeah, I was just gonna ask you about that. I mean, because I think, you know, part of what I was catching from this, by the time you speak out, I mean, you've already grappled with this question of faith and abuse and trusting someone who's teaching you about God and then is acting in such devilish ways. But then when you come forward with those stories, then it forces all of those around you to now also have to grapple with that and to reimagine the church that they perhaps, you know, siblings grew up in or parents were, you know, part of and trusted faith figures that they, and, you know, all of a sudden all of the stories now have a different tint to them. And that sometimes we don't want to grapple with the new reality.
I think that's exactly right. And I've heard from a couple old childhood friends who grew up in the church youth group with me. And it is exactly that. I think it's very hard for them because, of course, they have very good memories of fun times in the youth group. And now, all of a sudden, there's this other something that they never saw before that is deeply disturbing. It's tough.
So let's talk a little bit about your story. And you lay it out in numerous chapters. So, we're not going to be able to give it the kind of justice in this conversation that you do in your book. But I'll be honest, as you were talking about the story, your own personal story in the first part of the book of abuse, the level of spiritual abuse mixed in with the sexual abuse was the part that was, so incredibly stunning to me of, the encounters where the youth pastor is both sexually abusing you and then also using God language, both before you talk about this process of grooming and then, during and after the incidents as well. I wonder if you could share, I know we can't share the whole story here, but just that experience, because you're just talking about friends that grew up in the same church and now wrestling with their memories of the youth pastor, and it's completely different. I mean, that's what I think is what is particularly difficult and, traumatic with the faith abuse context, right? Because it was so mixed in together. And so then that's why a lot of survivors walk away completely from the church. So what would you like to share in a short version of the stories? And then hopefully readers will decide to pick up the memoir and read the rest of it.
And I'm so glad you picked up on this, because that is part of what I really wanted to get across in the book, was because I think people underestimate that and don't fully realize the extent to which faith can be weaponized. And which is exactly what happens for many, many people. All of those Bible verses just wound up being twisted in ways that could be used against me. I mean, I was a kid, I was a kid who loved God heart and soul and wanted only to please and serve God. And so to have a pastor telling me things and quoting Bible verses, lean not unto thine own understanding, if I raise questions, well, no, that's sinful. Lean not to thine own understanding. And dozens of verses like that, that get twisted. And I think that's such a powerful weapon for someone who is raised from toddlerhood in faith. I think it was Sarah Stancorb who somewhere wrote, when paired with faith, abuse is a unique violence. And I think that is exactly right. It is unique because of that power that the faith holds, both for the victim who incorporates all that, but the power then when it's twisted and weaponized by clergy perpetrators. Yes, people walk away from faith, sometimes completely, sometimes partly. Certainly we grapple with it massively. And that's because, for me, all of that traditional faith stuff, all of that kind of traditional God talk, it's not a choice. It's not a cognitive thing going on. It is neurologically networked in my body with the bodily memories of childhood rape. And that's not something I can really shift around much intellectually.
And as if that's not bad enough, then as you document the story, others knew, yes, and did nothing. There's a particular moment where there's finally another church leader who you tell your story to, and then you come to later realize that they actually already knew, and then also do nothing to stop the abuse.
That felt to me as just a massive betrayal years later when I learned that he had already known, because the perpetrator himself, the youth pastor, had talked with him about it. That just felt as such a massive betrayal. And of course, it did me a great deal of harm too, because, I mean, in most cases, sexual abuse, when it begins, it kind of escalates. So it gets worse over time as it goes on. And with me, it went on for many months. And the fact that he could have stopped it so much sooner. And he was my piano teacher too. This was someone who really knew me. Someone whom I just revered, my piano teacher. I sought only to please him. And to realize what a betrayal that was really devastating for me. And I think it is for many survivors. I mean, countless survivors I have listened say, what did them even greater harm than the sexual abuse itself was the response of others and how they were treated. Universally, almost, clergy sex abuse survivors will say this.
Yeah, in fact, this is how you write about that exact issue at one point in the book. When survivors seek to report abusive pastors within the faith community, that already shattered trust often gets pulverized into dust. In story after story of faith-based cruelty, clergy sex abuse survivors told me that how the church mistreated them caused even more trauma than the abuse itself. That was my own experience as well, with religious leaders circling their wagons around the good old boy network rather than rendering aid. Most people can scarcely bear to even contemplate child sexual abuse, and yet those who have actually lived that reality, as horrific as it is, almost always say that the church's mistreatment of them was something even worse. That mistreatment is what, for many, annihilates any last remaining possibility of feeling safe in faith.
Yeah, it is very, very hard to feel safe in faith when faith has been used to eviscerate. And by feel safe in faith, I don't just mean feel safe going into a church. I mean feel safe with faith within. That is a hard thing to feel safe with.
So for those that don't know your story, I think it's important to note that your abuser just keeps on moving on through Southern Baptist life and getting bigger pulpits, bigger churches to serve and minister in, even as people know what he has done.
Yes, the whole time. I mean, his career prospered. If anything, it prospered. He moved to a bigger church, a higher salary, and eventually moved to a very, very, very prominent church. His career totally prospered while I was left to grapple with things very much all on my own.
And then there's also the moment, and I'll be honest, this one stunned me as well, of where he has you apologize to his wife.
Right. That was as he was on the way out. I mean, he already had the next job lined up. I went into his office. Yeah, I mean, he told me this was what I needed to do, right? And so being the good girl I was, this is what I did. And I literally just blubbered and begged for her to forgive me. I said it was my fault. That was what I was told to say. So I said it. Those words came from my own mouth. And all she said was, I'll pray for you. And that was it. He also, at the tail end there, after months and months of this, made me kneel in his office while he laid his hands on me and stood over me, praying for God to cast Satan from me. And that was what I grew to believe at the time, because it was what I was told, was that I was a girl who had harbored Satan. And of course, that was terrifying.
So, I mean, people who have been following the debates and conversations and work in exposing the sexual abuse crisis and predators in Southern Baptist life for the last several years. I mean, I think many of them will recognize your name, and you've been one of the key voices, not only in sharing your own story, but in online and elsewhere, lifting up other voices and other stories. And that's something that you write about in the book. You know, one of the things that the way you frame this, you have your first death is what you call it, your childhood traumatic abuse. But then you actually take us through four deaths. And this is another one of your deaths, right? Is the way that Baptists respond to your story and the stories of others. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But first of all, this is the section where you particularly start to use the term that is the title of your memoir, Baptist Land. And it works in a really, you know, interesting way. And so let's talk about that. Why are you use this term Baptist land? What is that invoking for you as this, you know, noun to describe this force that you find yourself in?
Well, I think it's because Baptist land is more than a Baptist church. It's more than the Southern Baptist Convention. I mean, it is the way some of these beliefs and constraints are in our culture. I mean, someone can be in Baptist land without ever having set foot in a Baptist church. And it, you know, it affects, you know, families, and it's not just what happens within the church, but it is the influence of the faith group in the broader community, in the broader culture. I mean, we see it in policymaking bodies. We see it in school boards with book bannings. We see it and in all sorts of ways in state houses across the country, particularly, I would say, in the South, but not exclusively. I mean, it's like one survivor I talked with who was a city manager for a kind of smallish to mid-size-ish city in the South. And he wanted to go public with his abuse and wanted to, and he tried to, but he was very afraid. And what he told me was, Krista, Baptists run the whole town. I mean, I will lose my job. I will get run out of town. And he was really, really afraid. I mean, he had his whole career built there. His family was there. And I think that speaks to the extent to which Baptist land is part of our culture and part of communities.
Yeah, I mean, and I also think it's important to think about this because, you know, before you and some of the other survivors began speaking up, clergy sexual abuse, and you note this in the book, was a Catholic problem, right? That's the way it was often described, not only in the press, but even by like Southern Baptist leaders who knew that there wasn't just a Catholic problem. But it was, you know, something unique about Catholic, and people were coming up with theories, you know, it's the priest celibacy, or, you know, all these, you know, what is it about the Catholic Church, the hierarchy, you know, that makes it, you know, susceptible to this type of abuse. And we now know that it's just as bad, if not worse, in Baptist land than it was in Catholic life. And so what is it? Is it just the power and the structure and all the people together that Baptist land and, you know, the Catholic hierarchy all seem to circle the wagons and protect their own over children?
Well, that's certainly a part of it, that they protect their own, both in Catholicism and in Baptist land. I also really believe that there is, I mean, child sexual abuse happens everywhere, but part of what makes it extremely difficult, I think, in Baptist land is that there is an underlying current of authoritarianism within the faith, within the very theology. And I think that affects the response, which makes the response to abuse when it's found out really, really awful and so much more enormously, exponentially damaging. And I do think that when you have a theology, I mean, with Southern Baptists, of course, it goes all the way back to slavery. We can start there, I think. And I'm no theologian. I don't purport to be. I just kind of look at what I see and try to tell what I see. But I think when you have a basic theology that says some people, by the very nature of how they are born, should have someone else in authority over them, which is what Southern Baptists now effectively say with complementarianism. Women should graciously submit. It was always the gracious part that really got me. It's not enough to just submit. We're supposed to graciously submit. But anyway, I just think when you have that kind of theology, that sets up these authoritarian patterns. And those patterns, I think, foster abuse. And then that gets complicated still further when you have that theology and combine it with a structure that is virtually wholly lacking in effective systems of accountability. It is just an awful combination that wreaks devastation in countless people's lives. Speaking of authoritarianism, I'm not sure exactly what your new book is about, but I think you have a new book coming out in June, am I right?
That's correct.
Which might be touching on some of this.
I do think that the Christian nationalism, which is, supports those, the patriarchy and the authoritarianism, mm-hmm. and everyone has to get in line and there is a hierarchy. And so I don't think that that is unrelated from what you're talking about with Baptist land. So this systemic issue is really important. And this is something that you highlight. You note that, you've talked about your story a lot. You have an earlier book where you talked about your story. And one of the things that you admit in this memoir that you were frustrated by was how a lot of people focused on just the individual perpetrator and not the systemic responses. We've already talked a little bit about other people knowing, but then your third death, as you're talking about, is when you're speaking publicly and you're having problems with getting other Baptist churches and institutions in, the Baptist General Convention of Texas, who, as you note, are supposed to be the good guys in Texas, right? And getting pushback, and they're fighting. And so this is how you write a little bit about the systemic nature of what's happening in Baptist land. Speaking out against Baptist clergy sexual abuse began to feel like an endless whack-a-mole exercise in some sadistic, surreal circus. Hundreds of names began to blur in my mind. As soon as one predatory pastor was knocked down, another would pop up. The problem was systemic, but it seemed people in Baptist land simply didn't believe in systemic issues. With a theology oriented towards individual sin and individual piety, their lens was limited, which in turn constrained any notions of institutional accountability. So the cycle continued again and again, with survivors mustering media attention only to have SBC leaders say or do some tiny something to momentarily give the illusion of caring before they showed the institution's true recalcitrant colors. So let's talk about that. I mean, that systemic part is what's really important here is, because it would be easy. I mean, your memoir, as you mentioned, it's a narrow slice of history. It is your story. And your story matters, but your story is also an example of all of these other stories that happen. And when they're piled together, and, I think, reporters, the Houston Chronicle and others, documenting hundreds of cases, then it can't be just dismissed as an individual issue. And yet we've been seeing these debates at Southern Baptist conventions now for 20 years of popping back up and promising to do something. And then a few years go by and it pops back up and they promise to do something and nothing really changes other than, some nice press releases get put out.
Exactly. Even worse than nothing really changes, from my perspective, watching it, is seeing how they now use this to get their own positive PR. Of, oh, look what we did. Look how much we care. Oh, precious children. And it's all for their own self-serving ends, is how it looks to me. And I think this, it is definitely a systemic issue. And what I see is, again, I think this goes back some to the theology that focuses on individual sin and individual piety. And it is the same thing that prevents them from seeing systemic racism. It's the same thing that I think causes them to resist any kind of critical race theory. They don't want to talk about that because that goes counter to the whole notion that it's just each individual. But of course, it's a systemic issue. There's no way, I don't see how a rational person can look at it anymore and not see that.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
So, I mean, I know the struggle continues, and we'll have another Southern Baptist Convention meeting here in a month and a half. Your book will be officially out before then. I mean, do you think anything's going to actually happen this year? Or are we, this has been a topic. There's been a lot of conversation the last couple of years, and there's been promises to do more, but, it keeps not materializing.
I'm not hopeful. My only hope is, always to put the truth out there of what's really happening. And that's not as easy as it sounds, because we're talking about a multi-million-dollar institution, multi-tentacled institution, which has its own press arms, national and in many states, which hires and spends millions of dollars on crisis management people, attorneys, and public relations professionals. They have the means to control the narrative and to make things seem other than what they are, which is what they've been doing for a long, long time. So another Southern Baptist Convention annual meeting is coming up in June. And, if I were making a prediction, I would think we would see more of the same, that they will do as little as they think they can get away with doing to try to make themselves look good and to polish their image a little bit, but that it will not really truly be meaningful in terms of impacting the problem in an earnest, good faith, and serious way. If I were predicting, I would predict that they might put a dozen names at this point on a database. And they'll all be names of people who have already been previously exposed in the media, who probably have criminal convictions. So these are very easy ones. It's not like the institution will be taking responsibility for outing its own abusive pastors. They will simply, do some little duplicate of what's already been done by other people. And they will just massively self-applaud themselves for what they have done. But meanwhile, of course, by now there should be 1,000 names on a database. They've known about this. It is impossible to think that they have not known about this. Once you get to 2007, which was the ABC 2020 expose, SBC leaders at all levels have known about this for sure. And they likely knew about it well before then. And then 5 years ago, it's already been 5 years since the Abuse of Faith series by the Houston Chronicle and San Antonio Express News. 5 years. And we've got almost nothing that's been done. And now it's been 2 years since the Guidepost report. And again, they just keep kicking the can down the road and doing as little as possible.
So, I mean, you mentioned that you keep going because you want to put the truth out there, and that is more difficult than it sounds. And I mean, your story bears that out, right? As people will read in your memoir, the responses you've had in Baptist land, not just criticism and attacks or being ignored, but even just attorneys, high-powered attorneys being paid, because this is a wealthy organization with lots of wealthy tentacle organizations, as you noted. So there's that kind of pushback. There's the estrangement that happens in family. What keeps you and the other survivors going? Because it can look like it's a hopeless cause, and maybe and maybe the SBC is beyond redemption. I would like to think that there's still hope for the broader church somewhere. But what keeps you continuing to show up and to push them to finally do something better?
Well, I don't think, obviously this has been an evolutionary process for me over a couple decades. And once upon a time, I really truly, and I think now very naively, did believe that if only I could put enough cases out there, if only I could show them the extent of the problem, that they would surely do something. I believed all that, heart and soul. I don't believe that anymore. At this point, I do think that institutionally, the Southern Baptist Convention, well, certainly I don't expect to see them make meaningful change in my lifetime. I'm getting older. I just don't figure it's going to happen. But I don't think the hope that I hold doesn't really turn on what the Southern Baptist Convention does or does not do. I think I just hold hope for the impact of having the truth out there that that can have in other people's lives. Because I think for every survivor who sees that they aren't alone, who sees that, oh, these patterns, you know, this happens to hundreds of people. And they're able to kind of begin to process that in ways that they didn't before. I think for every survivor that holds hope for change in their own life, their own lives, holds hope for change in their children's lives and their grandchildren's lives. And I think all of that is worth doing for those reasons, for the individual people involved. And I also, speaking of individuals, just want to say, you know, I know that there are good and decent individuals within the Southern Baptist Convention. I know that. At the same time, I also think institutionally that this institution is not changing.
I mean, that's the power of a concept like Baptist Land, right? That even the good individuals will find themselves unable to really make a difference in the system.
Right.
You also gave us a little bit of a hint of how you, in the book, you personally do find joy and hope and love in children, grandchildren, right? It keeps you going each day. And I think that that's also, it was a nice reward at the end of the book to get to that.
Good. I'm glad. Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, life is good. You know, which doesn't minimize, you know, a lot of these traumas. And I think those stay with me too. They exist side by side, the goodness with all of that. But life is good. And I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, side by side, because that is actually, that's how you in the book is this, the good and the bad and seeing both and existing and, you know, on a smaller scale, all of us experience that at least at some level of the good and bad are mixed in our own church and faith journey, in our own family lives, with our own parents, our own siblings, our own kids. We all have those moments that we're really excited and proud of and those moments that we wished had never happened. And I think you very beautifully just acknowledge that those exist at the same time.
And I do think that's right. I mean, you don't have to be a clergy sex abuse survivor to have... I hope the book will also resonate with a lot of people who have experienced what it's like to grow up in either a high control faith group or a high control kind of a family with high control dynamics. And, you know, you wind up being put into a box where you become smaller and trying to get out of that box can be very, very difficult. And I think that happens in all sorts of contexts for people.
So the book comes out in May. People can pre-order it now anywhere. What do you hope people will take from the book? I mean, I know, you know, you're putting your truth out and hoping that, and we've already talked a little bit about what will or won't happen in SBC life, but for anybody, whether they're Baptist or not, and they pick up this book, what do you hope that will come from this story being out in the world?
I hope that many people will see and better understand how the religious culture in this country can be exploited for harm against individuals, harm against our society, harm in our society. And it can be exploitative and is flawed. I hope people will see the desperate need for effective systems of accountability. And I hope for many people, in whatever context it is, that people are trying to assert their own authentic self. I hope that they will see the possibilities, you know, small steps by small steps by small steps, and the value of pursuing that journey toward your own authentic self. And so I hope people will see that as well, because that's not an easy thing to do for people raised in high control environments. And so I would say, man, every step of the way, bravo, bravo. You know, give yourself credit for the small steps.
So as we wrap up here, if someone's listening and besides, you know, reading through your story, or, you know, they want to get involved, they want to do more, and whether it's they need resources for helping work through their own past experiences of abuse, or they just want to be an ally and to be part of the solution, what are some organizations, some resources that you would recommend for people to kind of check out as a first step?
I still, to this day, think that SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, is a fantastic organization that has done enormous good for a lot of people. It has the word priests in the name, and that was how they got their start, was working with Catholic survivors, but now they work with all kinds of survivors, and they are a wholly independent organization, which I think is very, very important. And there's another group called Into Account, which works individually with survivors to try to help them at whatever point they are in their path. And they too are wholly and completely independent. So I would certainly recommend those two.
Well, the book is Baptist Land, A Memoir of Abuse, Betrayal, and Transformation. Krista, thanks so much for joining us on the program, but even more so for not only this book, but all that you have been doing in raising your voice and lifting up and supporting the voices of, unfortunately, so many others. I really appreciate it. And your courage and your tenacity is inspiring.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wardenway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wardenway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wardenway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wardenway.org. Thanks for listening.